Hello, and welcome to episode 85 of the Reconomy Podcast, where we discuss economic issues that impact real estate, housing, and affordability. I'm Xander Snyder, Senior Commercial Real Estate Economist at First American, and here with me is Mark Fleming, Chief Economist at First American. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Xander. And then there were two.
Indeed. For our regular listeners, you'll notice Odetta won't be joining us today. She's on the road sharing her expertise on the wide world of residential real estate.
So that means today will be another CRE-focused episode because these days that's where all the action is. Xander, it's hard to miss that there's been concern lately about commercial real estate because of the impact of higher rates, work-from-home dynamics, and that many CRE loans are coming due this year and next. But what often gets missed in that coverage is that commercial real estate isn't uniform.
Right. Economists would refer to commercial real estate as a highly heterogeneous good, which is just kind of a wonky way of saying most commercial properties are different from one another.
I really like heterogeneous and homogeneous. Big words are helpful sometimes. Different shapes, different locations, and of course, different commercial purposes all drive heterogeneity of commercial real estate.
That's right. In fact, different types of commercial properties are typically categorized by the type of business that's conducted in them. Most people associate commercial real estate with office buildings, but there are also retail centers, malls, hotels, and what we're going to talk about today, industrial properties. These are all types of commercial real estate, or different types of asset classes. And not all of them face the same sort of demand reduction that the office market is going through right now as a consequence of remote work.
And chances are, unless you work in an industrial business, you're not very familiar with this type of property. A lot of people have worked in offices, so they're more familiar with those. And everyone's gone shopping, so they're familiar with the different types of retail or stayed in a hotel. But there typically aren't reasons for someone to visit an industrial property unless they work there or manage it. And these days, a lot of industrial properties run the cloud and our favorite AI chatbots. More on that in a minute.
That's right. And I think the lack of familiarity among the general public of industrial properties is part of why media coverage of commercial real estate lately has focused predominantly on office buildings. It's what we're familiar with. That and, of course, there are real concerns about long-term demand for office space. So office has dominated the CRE news of late.
Right. But one interesting aspect of commercial real estate's heterogeneity is that each asset class has unique fundamentals, which means that certain economic trends impacting one type may differently impact others. And there are a lot of long-term determinants of demand for industrial space, which we'll get into in a minute. But first, what exactly do we even mean when we say industrial property? What types of buildings are we talking about?
So industrial as an asset class is a pretty varied category in its own right. There are a lot of different types of industrial properties. For example, factories are industrial properties, but so are warehouses and data centers. Cold storage for food distribution and logistic facilities are also types of industrial properties.
So as you said at the beginning, it's often classified based upon the business purpose distinguishing industrial properties from other types. But are there other reasons why you can distinguish them?
Well, again, to draw a distinction between industrial and office specifically, one major difference is the lease structure. So office leases are typically what's called gross leases, and industrial leases are almost always net leases. And don't get too caught up in the terminology here. The only difference between the two is who pays for what, the tenant or the landlord. In a gross lease, the landlord pays for all or most of the operating expenses in a building, such as utilities, repairs and maintenance, insurance premiums, and property taxes. By contrast, with a net lease, the tenant pays for some or all of these operating expenses. And there are different types of net leases, but one of the most common is called a triple net lease. And this is where the tenant covers all common area expenses. And the landlord only pays for the large capital expenditure. So, say, for equipment that will remain fixed to the building over the course of multiple lease periods.
Okay, so that means with industrial properties, landlords aren't exposed to the risk of rising operating expenses, which is something that has been a concern in some of the other asset classes. specifically office buildings, but why would any landlord ever choose a gross lease? In other words, why isn't everything net lease structured?
Well, the main reason is that it's difficult to parse out costs in a big office building with lots of different tenants. Imagine a high-rise building, and in a high-rise building, for example, you could have dozens of tenants or more. And it's often difficult to know exactly how much water or electricity each one is using unless the building is extensively sub-metered, and most aren't. Plus, in office buildings, you know, there's often a lobby that serves all of the tenants. There may be a security desk there or a gym, and these are offered by the landlord as an amenity to attract tenants. Typically, industrial properties have fewer tenants, and a lot are actually single-tenant properties. And that makes it easier to calculate a tenant's share of building costs and pass them through.
That makes a lot of sense. And so, as we hinted at the top of the show, the industrial story right now is actually not as bad as many of the other asset classes. In fact, generally one of resilience. But why is that the case right now?
Yeah, that's right. And so when we talk about an asset class's fundamentals, we generally mean how supply and demand forces interact with each other, both for owning the properties and for leasing the space in the properties. And, you know, no surprise, these two are related. So let's touch on that demand side first. The long-term demand determinants for industrial are fairly strong. You know, for example, the rise of e-commerce over the last decade or so has greatly increased the need for warehouse and distribution facilities. Though e-commerce sales temporarily spiked during the pandemic quarantine, they were gradually rising for many years before then. The need for this space has resulted in a lot of new industrial construction, since the shift from brick and mortars retail to online shopping isn't over.
Yeah, and Sander, there's one stat that I continue to find particularly revealing about this dynamic of brick and mortar retail versus e-commerce, and that is that only about 15% of all retail sales come from e-commerce, even though we sort of maybe think of it as a much bigger share. In other words, there's a ton of room for e-commerce to continue to grow. If retail sales continue to move online, which is the expectation, there will presumably be even greater demand for warehouse and logistics space in the near future.
Exactly. And in addition to that, it's not just online retailers that need warehouse space. Brick and mortar retailers also need advanced logistic capabilities and to ensure that they have the products in stock when their customers do visit their stores or can at least get them quickly. Heading into the pandemic, there simply wasn't enough industrial space out there to cater to the surge in demand to purchase goods online that occurred. And that contributed to record low vacancy rates, rapid growth in industrial property prices, and a surge in new industrial construction in order to meet that demand.
It's almost like retail immediate gratification requirements driving demand for industrial space. And that's just warehouses. Beyond that, data centers are a niche subset class of industrial that's getting a lot more attention now, given the rising need of computing power for AI and more generally everything moving to the cloud. Fun fact, I live in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C., near the single largest concentration of data centers in the world. Based on megawatts of electricity consumption, dare I say my head is practically in the clouds.
That might explain some things.
Oh, and wait, and then there's Electric Avenue nearby, 1982, Eddie Grant. No, I'm really resisting trying to sing it here. Too much. I'm pretty sure the listeners don't want to hear me do that. So we've talked a bit about the demand side. Let's hop over to the supply side of the equation. That is deliveries of new industrial space. Due to all these pandemic dynamics, a record amount of industrial construction started during the pandemic, with under construction space peaking at over 700 million square feet in the third quarter of 2022. That new construction is being delivered to the market now and will continue throughout the year, which raises the question, is there still enough demand to absorb it all?
It's a good consideration, but I think the short answer is yes, there is sufficient demand, with the caveat that, of course, it will vary by geography.
Yes, all real estate, even this asset class, is local after all.
Indeed. So when thinking about the risks to rents and prices from new supply, all of this new construction that you were talking about, I sometimes like to perform a worst case scenario sort of analysis. And the idea here is if the worst situation you could possibly think of came to pass, what would the impact be on some measure of performance? So in the case of industrial properties, we can look at the roughly 415 million square feet currently under construction and say, what would happen if all of this space were delivered fully vacant and unleased? Of course, this won't actually happen since industrial space is in demand. But if it were to happen as a worst case scenario, the national industrial vacancy rate would increase to about 8% from 6%, which it is, where it is right now.
That doesn't seem so bad, at least in the amount of change. I mean, that's only 2 percentage points. But is 8 even a lot or a little? How do we put that figure into context?
Well, one way is to look at history and ask, what's the last time an 8% vacancy rate occurred? And how did the industrial market respond? So late 2013 was that last time that industrial vacancy rate, the national industrial vacancy rate, reached 8%. And back then, annual industrial rent growth was about 3.5%. In other words, moderate positive rent growth is entirely possible with an 8% vacancy rate. And again, this is the worst case scenario, and I doubt that the vacancy rate will reach 8% nationally based on the current supply pipeline.
So the real takeaway here is it seems that there is a lot of new industrial space coming to market, but it's unlikely to lead to a glut of new space because there's still lots of demand for space to run the cloud, to send me my music, and store me my future Amazon purchases.
Yeah, that's how I read the numbers. And that doesn't mean that industrial isn't facing a slowdown compared to the pandemic era market, but arguably, the pandemic era industrial market ran extremely hot for a couple of years, and both slow and overheated markets can be unhealthy. All of the new supply of industrial space coming to market is therefore more of a normalization and a reversion to a well-balanced market than, say, the beginning of widespread distress for industrial.
Yeah, we talk in so many aspects these days about not too hot, not too cold, just right. This seems to be another one trying to get to just right, which is definitely good perspective to have. One interesting aspect of this conversation on construction is that it can act both as a supply measure, new deliveries coming to market, and a demand measure, new construction starts due to increased demand to own properties. And while we didn't have time today to get into a deeper discussion about industrial cap rates, Xander, you did just publish an update of First American's proprietary potential cap rate model, which uses this front-end and back-end aspect of construction to model industrial cap rates.
Yes, indeed. And we've included a link to that blog post in the show notes for this episode. In it, I go into a little greater detail on how construction can act as this dual measure of supply and demand. If you're interested in what's happening to industrial cap rates, be sure to check it out.
While economists might also be known as dismal scientists, it was good chatting with you about an underreported bright spot in the world of commercial real estate, Xander.
Thanks, Mark. Good chatting with you as well. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Reconomy Podcast. And as always, if you can't wait for the next episode, follow us on X at Xander Snyder X for me and at M Fleming Econ for Mark. See you next time.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Reconomy Podcast from First American. We're pleased to offer you even more economic content at firstam.com/economics. This episode is copyright 2024 by First American Financial Corporation. All rights reserved.